to the highest level. Second, I want to note, it's been a while coming, but the Center for Racial Justice and Equitable Futures will launch in January. And I am especially delighted that the founding director will be Jamila Michener, Associate Professor of Government and Senior Associate Dean of Public Engagement at the Brooks School. Some of you know Jamila. She's an internationally recognized scholar working in American politics and policy with a special emphasis on the causes and consequences of poverty and racial inequality. She is really the perfect leader for the new center. And third, because I know it's always of interest to this group, I want to give a quick update on our continued path towards carbon neutrality by 2035, and in particular, let you know about a project I'm very excited about. It's a new 110 megawatt solar voltaic project in Batavia, New York, so just up the road. Once it goes online, which will be no later than 2025, we're going to get to a critical milestone in our sustainability goals. We will meet the electricity needs, so not all the heating needs, but the electricity needs of our campus with 100% renewable energy. So this is a big deal. I'm very excited about it. And our work on operational sustainability continues to be recognized externally. Last year, we were the first university to receive a platinum rating from ASHI, that's the Association for the Advancement of Sustainability in Higher Education. We were the first university to get platinum 3 times in a row, and this year we earned it for a 4th time. So this is something we are really committed to and working hard on. Beyond that, what I want to spend my time on today is saying a little bit about the extraordinarily difficult past few weeks, the moment we're in now. Much of what I want to say to you today, I did share at the Faculty Senate a few weeks ago, but I think it's also very relevant for the University Assembly. So for those of you who are at Faculty Senate, apologies for the duplication. 4 years ago, we did something very important at Cornell. We codified a set of core values, 6 core values. And among them, 2 were free and open inquiry and expression and being a community of belonging. Now, regrettably, we live in a world where creating communities of belonging is not always valued. And we at Cornell don't stand wholly apart from the world. So over the years that I've been president for almost 7 years now, 6.5 years, I have unfortunately had to denounce acts and expressions of hate and bigotry multiple times on campus, both on campus and off, and involving a wide range of targeted identities. Since the Hamas attacks on Israel on October 7th, across the country and around the world, we've seen a dramatic and frightening and disturbing rise in instances of hatred, particularly instances of both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. So here at Cornell, we need to redouble our commitment to belonging and inclusion. We will, of course, continue to respond forcefully to all threats. We will continue to provide support to affected students and faculty and staff, and we will continue to do what we do best, which is develop and offer education and conduct research that can help us understand the causes of and the ways to intervene against hatred and bigotry. We have a track record in all of that, and we need to keep doing it. That's what we do as a university. And I want to be really crystal clear that our commitment is to fight all forms of hatred. We care about all members of our community, and we will not tolerate hatred or bigotry in any form. Anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, racism, transphobia, we will not tolerate any of that. Now, all that said, there can be tension sometimes between being a community of belonging and honoring free and open expression. But we're a university, and our responsibility is to find ways to manage these tensions, to demonstrate how thoughtful people who have rich and nuanced value sets can manage the stresses that sometimes arise among those values. When we're faced, for example, with deeply offensive or hateful speech, we can, both as individuals and as an institution, respond to it. We can support those who are affected by it. And importantly, we can offer counterstatements. Although at the institutional level, we need to do that cautiously. We need to speak only rarely and in cases where the speech is truly egregious. But let me reiterate what I've said in several venues, including most recently to the Faculty Senate, because I am very concerned. Are there any faculty? No faculty here today. Faculty, okay. I think this has been a particular concern for faculty. I am very concerned with the growing chorus of voices calling for universities to step back from the fundamental commitment to free speech in light of recent events. This often gets manifest in calls to ban hate speech. There is, of course, no such legal category in the United States. Hateful speech is protected speech in the United States, as opposed to threats or incitement to violence. like many people in this room, like many people on this campus, I am troubled by the ease with which people casually toss around hateful expressions. And one of the goals of our free expression theme year is to encourage people to recognize that even if they have the right to say something, effective participation in a community and effective participation in a democracy should lead them to carefully consider their words and the impact of those words on people around them. But as I have said over the years, efforts to suppress speech that runs short of direct threats or incitement to violence is fraught and it's dangerous. It's dangerous and fraught because it begs the question of who gets to decide what counts as hate speech. And it has repeatedly been shown to be ineffective at best and even counterproductive. So if you go back to the Weimar Republic, there were multiple laws suppressing the speech of Nazis. And yet not only the Nazis rise to power, but that they twisted those same laws to their own purposes. And in fact, there are some historians who believe that the speech suppression actually increased sympathy for the Nazi causes. There's another historical example that is just critically important for us at a university to keep in mind. And that is what happened when there was fear of communism. And it led to really severe speech suppression that defined the Red Scare and McCarthyism, damaging the lives of so many people and putting a terrible stain on so many universities. Now, again, there's a difference between hate speech and hate crimes. So the online death threats against our Jewish students, a specific building on campus, that was a hate crime. That wasn't just hate speech. Hate crimes are never tolerated. And there are rare cases where a faculty member's speech is so extreme that they are deemed by their peers unable to fulfill their role as professors, but that bar is appropriately very, very high. So all of that said, free speech and academic freedom, in my view, are just absolutely fundamental, not only to academia, but to our democracy. And so I am, as I said, terribly concerned about sudden calls to rapidly move the line on free speech, calls largely from outside the university, to do that rather than doubling down on education about how to interact with each other in appropriate ways and how to use our own voices to counter offensive and hateful speech, including, of course, speech that is anti-Semitic, that is Islamophobic, that is racist, that is sexist, that is transphobic, that is bigoted and hateful of any kind. We are a community of more than 27,000 students, 4,000 faculty, and 13,000 staff across our campuses, and we need to remind the world of all of the good that goes on at Cornell every day. So before I turn to your questions, and you submitted a large number of questions in advance, which we can go through, thank you. But before we do that, and because in the sort of spirit of it being right after Thanksgiving, I want to read a small excerpt from a really absolutely beautiful piece that was written by one of our professors, Jane Marie Law. She's a professor of religious studies. It was entitled An Everyday Miracle at Cornell. I wish I had time to read the whole essay. I don't. I brought copies of it. Those of you online can get copies later. Let me just read you an excerpt, because to me it epitomizes Cornell. Professor Law says this. She said this was written, I don't know, about a month ago. It is unusual to have the university where I teach, Cornell in Ithaca, New York, be in the national news for the same reason for extended period of time. Usually national news celebrates the accomplishment of some scholar or some unusual student, and it's a flash in the pan. Somebody wins a Nobel Prize or a national or international award. That's what should be in the news every day about my institution. Amazing things happen at Cornell every single day. So it has been very unsettling to be on the front page of major media day in and day out for weeks on end for other reasons. But I don't want to talk about that. Let me instead tell you about a class I'm teaching right now. This class is held in the crappiest classroom I've ever had in Cornell, a basement room devoid of any decoration save a chalkboard and tiny windows way up high, overgrown not with ivy but weeds, some inside the room because it's a basement, and the walls are painted in off-white with desks that are not fixed and with utterly no charm. The room barely fits the 24 of us. Among the 23 students are just about every form of diversity one can imagine: racial, ethnic, socioeconomic, nationality, gender, religious, dietary, able-bodied and not, and political. In this small class, I have 8 different major religions represented. I have 6 different countries represented. I have all hues of political persuasion represented. Incredible diversity is the norm here. And let me tell you something really special about my students, particularly the group this semester. After the massacre on October 7th by Hamas against Jews in the kibbutzim, and the subsequent invasion of Gaza by the Israeli Defense Forces, and the unfolding and unrelenting horror of the high casualties among Palestinian civilians in Gaza, my students did not scramble to find a simple position to take. They opened up to one another in remarkable ways, and led by our discussions in class and the kind of atmosphere that is actually fairly common in these kind of diverse settings, they listened to one another and showed an enormous care for one another that was beyond avoiding uncomfortable conversations. Rather than hardening into ideological positions, the view you would have if you read mainstream media, they got soft and open to one another. They may have had to be reminded by me that as a class, they represent nothing short of a miracle of humanity. But I think the real miracle is the realization that when you put a diverse group of students in a small classroom to do productive work together, something happens. Donors and political figures and harsh critics of American academia need to realize that the students and the professors and the scholars working at these major research institutions are doing something very difficult and very rare. We are actually living diversity. We see people building relationships that will last a lifetime with people very different from themselves. People really do share, discover their shared humanity. To me, Professor Law's words are just a remarkable example of the power of Cornell. And they remind me that we need to continue to stand for all that's good for our university and this community and continue in our essential work of teaching and learning, scholarship and research, and engagement with good for good with the world. So I have brought copies. I hope you'll read it. It's really just quite a remarkable essay. And I just thought in the spirit, there's been so much bad news lately of sharing something so positive. So those are my prepared comments. You guys very helpfully submitted question and answer. Do you want me to go through them kind of one at a time? How would you like me to do this?
Yeah, one at a time is fine.
Okay. So the first question, I'll probably do two because I don't have much of an answer to the first question. The first question is, what have you and the university learned from the political conflicts on campus arising from the Israel-Hamas war? And honestly, the answer is it is just too soon to answer this question. The war is still going on. There's still tension on campus. Students are still working through, students and faculty and staff working through strong emotions. What I can say is that, as is always the case, when we work through conflicts on campus, we're continually reflecting, we're continually making adjustments as we try to find the best path forward. But it's just too soon to answer the question, whatever you want. The second question was, how do you think the university can better promote learning and informed dialogue? So look, a focus on informed dialogue, especially dialogue across difference, that's been something I've been interested in since I got here. You can go back to my inauguration speech and I talked about it. We've put in place a number of programs over the years to help foster that. So who's a fresh, any freshmen or even sophomores? One of the things we have now is every incoming student has to do an intergroup dialogue project when they come in. And the intergroup dialogue project is one of the few programs that we know that there's data that shows that it really works to help people learn how to listen to and appreciate different perspectives. Over the past 6 weeks, you know, more specifically on Israel and Gaza and the Palestinians at Hamas, we've offered a number of seminars and lectures, and there have been a huge number of listening and discussion sessions for students, and we've had programs for faculty to provide them with tools and techniques to help teach in the complex situation. Beyond that, I would simply say that learning and informed dialogue, I mean, that's what we do as a university. I think everything we do every day is directed towards that. And so I just encourage people to take advantage of that. Okay, that was question number one and number two. I can go on or I can take question, whatever you want.
Maybe we get through the questions.
Okay.
Time to take.
Okay, because they were good questions. I'm going to do number three and four together because they're variants on the same question. Question three is, how can the university support students' access to intellectual resources and conversations necessary for them to explore the morally, politically, and legally complex dimensions of this conflict and others? And the next one is, that's roughly the same as the question I just addressed. I don't have much to add to that. The next one is actually on a very different topic. And it's a really good question. What are the institutional plans to enhance the regional transportation infrastructure to reduce overall cost of living for our campus community and enhance community development of healthcare infrastructure? What is Cornell doing to promote increased services within the wider Ithaca community among these facets? So I want to talk about three things. I want to talk about TCAT. I want to talk about the airport because the context part before this talks about the airport. And then I want to talk a little bit about healthcare. So TCAT, which I know has been a real problem. They have really struggled. There is There was a lot of misinformation out there saying they were struggling because we didn't give them money. That wasn't it. They had money. They couldn't hire people. Just as there was a labor shortage all over the country, they weren't able to hire, not so much bus drivers, I understand, but mechanics. But just last month, TCAD and Cornell reached a new four-year service agreement. So there are underwriter payments. There's already underwriter payments that are equal share city, county, and Cornell. And then we make annual additional payments to TCAT that will encourage and then subsidize its use by students, faculty, and staff. So just to remind you, faculty and staff ride free at all times on TCAT routes, and then they can purchase discounted passes for transit in adjacent counties that are connected with the TCAT routes. First year, transfer, and new to Cornell students ride TCAT at no cost at all times. All other undergraduate, graduate, and professional students ride free weekday evenings after 6 p.m. and all year. And after that first year, when you get that pass, you have the option to purchase an annual pass through the OmniRide program at a very substantial discount compared to TCAT's normal rate. We provide TCAT with more than $3.3 million to cover this benefit, and it is basically 80% of the local revenue that they get from passenger revenue. To better align, to sort of help deal with the service problems we've had and the evolving needs of our community, in this new agreement, we shifted from a service level, we shifted to a service level agreement that establishes target service levels, and it incentivized TCAT, financially incentivizes TCAT, to meet or exceed those levels. And if they do that, if they can achieve these increased levels of service, we'll pay them more, the money will go up, but there'll also be additional passenger revenue throughout the system because non-Cornell people will be much more likely to use it. This should help them with existing initiatives. And of course, you know, more bus riders means fewer cars on the road, reduces environmental impact on the environmental on carbon footprint and so on. So that's how we're working with TCAT. Tompkins Airport. Boy, I'm as frustrated. I mean, I have to travel a lot for my job. And, you know, before the pandemic, it was great. You could get to DC, you could get to Detroit. Now you can get to JFK and Newark. And most of the time you can't get to Newark because they cancel the flight. So I would love to have some back. The airport is operated by Tompkins County. It has an advisory board. It's called the Air Services Board. It does include community stakeholders. We have a seat. I think, does Joel have a seat on that?
Someone in
University Relations has a seat on that. We have been engaging with them to try and get more service. I mean, first of all, I would love to get the flight back to DC because so many of our faculty need to go to DC all the time. But across the country, regional airports lost a huge amount of flights since the pandemic, 76% fewer flights in 2020 than 2019. And the smaller the airport, and we're a pretty small airport, they lost a dramatically higher proportion. So we're doing what we can, but it's kind of fighting an uphill battle. I mean, I wish we're doing what we can, but I want to sort of set expectations. I'm not enormously optimistic. There was something in the paper last week that suggested that maybe we would get a DC flight back. I don't know, the Detroit flight. I mean, personally, I love the Detroit flight because my grandkids live in Ann Arbor. But beyond that, the Detroit flight was also a gateway out to the West. So it'd be nice to get a flight back to Detroit or Chicago. And finally, in healthcare, and this is more for faculty and staff, not for students, both of our regional healthcare providers, so it's Cayuga and Guthrie, they have very serious plans for future growth. They are working on future growth. That will mean more provider options for the community. One example, if you've driven down 13, is that new outpatient facility that was opened by Cayuga Health. They also have plans in the work to expand to Ithaca Mall. And all of this is being supplemented by telehealth, which I think people are increasingly taking advantage of. But again, it's tough. I mean, we live in a small area and we're doing what we can. Again, we do have Joel Molina, who is Vice President for University Relations, has a seat on the Cayuga Health System Board. Any questions on that? And I'll keep going. There's a lot of background here, but the bottom line question is, it's cultivating community for Black and brown professionals can be difficult. Do we have plans to do things to help people cultivate community beyond CNG? CNG is the colleague network groups that are very effective. I'm really glad that this question mentioned the colleague network groups, because they are really, really good resources to help people find community. And if you are staff or faculty, and it's not just for people of color, we have a veterans group, we have an LGBTQ group. There are a number of these colleague network groups. I used to be, each of them has a mentor, an executive mentor. I used to be, for part of a year, I was executive mentor for the Women of Color group. And it was a really wonderful group of people. But we also recently put out something called the Diverse Living in Ithaca Guide. It was released by our employee experience team just this fall. It's for new faculty and staff. I haven't seen it, so I'm gonna have to read this, but it has lists of multicultural organizations, housing options, beauty and hair salons, dining options, places of worship. Many of the recommendations come from colleague network group members. And if you don't, I have the link, but it's printed. If you want the link and you can't find it, just email president@cornell.edu and we'll get you that link. But check it out. Okay, question number six that you sent me. Question number six. Oh, we're doing plenty of time. How does Cornell plan to address the issue of doxing, fear of free speech, and psychological stress for all students? So first of all, I mean, what I said to you earlier in my comments, this is not the first time I've said it. It's like the eighth time I've said it. I continue to stress the critical importance of free expression as an institution of higher education. And I have consistently defended it. I've defended it for faculty who have said things over the last month in the classroom that led to some criticism. And we talked with them about thinking about how it might impact their students, but no one's been sanctioned. The students didn't like it, but I defended it when we wanted trigger warnings, because I thought when the students wanted trigger warnings, when SA wanted that, because I thought that really chilled free speech. It is of fundamental importance to me that we protect that. When we get grievances, complaints of doxing or complaints of any sort of bias or harassment, we take them very seriously. They go in if the respondent, that is the person who's accused of causing the problem, as a student, it goes to the Office of Student Conduct. Otherwise, it goes to the Office of Institutional Equity, and we try to follow up on all of them. Now, sometimes we get an anonymous complaint that says something like somebody posted something inappropriate on social media with no identifying and information, and there's just not much we can do about that. But whenever we can, we do follow up. The grief and the strong emotions that's being felt by everybody right now is real, and I get it. And so are the concerns then about expressing one's political and religious and ethnic beliefs. The world is just very, very polarized. It was polarized before the Israel-Hamas war. It's even more polarized now. And I recognize, leadership team recognizes, that the impacts of the war are going to impact groups differently. And our goal is to try and meet this moment with grace and empathy for everyone. We care about everyone. I care about every student on this campus. I can't always help every student on this campus. We care about everyone. We are in the process right now of reviewing a draft anti-doxing policy that we will bring to the appropriate governance structures for endorsement. But remember, doxing is tricky, right? We can have a policy and it will apply to people in our own community, but a lot of doxing happens by people outside the community, right? And we can't control that. So we are also working on a set of guidelines that can help people who have been doxed, help them deal with it, help them handle it. As I said, the Office of Institutional Equity and the Office of Student Conduct are following up on all claims of bias, unlawful discrimination, and all unlawful harassment. The numbers are actually low. The numbers are not as high as you think. Since October 7th, it's been in the handful of a few dozen, and as I say, a number of those are things like somebody posted something online, an anonymous complaint. This past month, it's been 13. We've had a total of 13. So it's, if you are experiencing something, please report it. We want to know. We want to follow up as best we can. When each of us agreed to be part of this community, this diverse academic community, each of us, I believe, took on the responsibility to find ways to learn and to teach and research and live across difference. And sometimes there are just very, very deep differences that challenge
our sense of self and belonging. And I think it's incumbent on everyone to really try and understand, when is this uncomfortable, maybe even very uncomfortable, very challenging, but part of what I need to experience as a human being, and when does it cross over the line? And when it crosses over the line, then report it.
Student Campus Life is actively engaged with all of our student leaders, our student groups to try and promote respectful engagement. The Provost's Office, as I mentioned, is working with CTI, the Center for Teaching Innovation, to provide educational programs and resources to faculty.
And of course, HR is the resource for the staff.
You might be interested, one of the upcoming Freedom of Expression theme year events on December 7th from noon to 1 at Gates Hall, a legal expert, Marianne Gates, is going to speak out on doxing, DEI, and the First Amendment. I think it'll be extremely interesting. And if you happen to be here and not taking a final or studying for final, that would be great. And finally, you know, as with all these kinds of crises, the situation in the Middle East has certainly caused psychological stresses for everyone. With respect to students, we continue to invest very, very heavily in mental health services. So please, please reach out and get support if you're a student and you need it. Questions on that? Yeah, Jamal. Yeah.
So my question on that essentially is, like, what are the sort of actionable steps to Cornell is going to take? Because a lot of, like I said, some of the other students I've spoken to is that the free speech theme or the free speech emphasis that Cornell is taking isn't necessarily for all students. That's when maybe students or faculty may say something that may threaten Cornell's image or threatens donors or something, that then they are targeted, harassed, or they're not having these protections. So what, outside of just like looking up resources online, are there sort of like actionable plans and things to be implemented to address students who feel that they cannot freely express their
differences? So what you need to do is, if you feel that has happened to you, you need to report it, because we will respond to every case you get. It is simply not true, Jamal, that we are favoring one group of students over another. We have been protecting the speech rights of all students. Now, I get that different groups, and I hear it from all the groups, right? Like you're hearing it from your group, but I hear it from different groups. All of the different groups are saying, oh, I'm afraid to express myself. Express yourself. I mean, express yourself. We will defend your right to express yourself. And if you are harassed, or you are threatened, or you are filmed, let us know and we'll do what we can. Again, if it's someone from outside the community who's doxed you, I can't do anything about that, right? I can only control what I can control. But we are not favoring any group. We support the free speech rights of every single student on this campus, and faculty and staff. So speak up. I mean, what else is there that we can do except say, do it? We will defend you. And we have defended. We have defended faculty who have said challenging things, for example. I mean, so you tell me, what are you looking for?
Oh, what I'm looking for, I feel like, at least from the students I've spoken to, I think the number right now, there's been 40 students who said they've been doxxed and posted, and they said that they've reached out to administration and others.
We have gotten literally one or two reports.
Well, what I'm saying is, no, reports versus being doxxed. I think a lot of them say that they don't feel that when they meet administration that there's any grace given.
But what I'm saying is, they're not telling us. If they're not telling me, how can I do anything? I've only gotten one or two reports. So if you report it, we can try and respond to it. If you don't report it, what can I possibly do? I don't know about it, right? So report it. And it is true, the student code actually has wording in it that will allow us to respond even now to some instances of doxing. But it is absolutely true that doxing is a fairly new phenomenon, and the code isn't quite as clear as it should be, which is why we're putting out this doxing policy to clarify further. But what I'm saying is, help me. If people don't report it, there is no way for me to respond to it.
Yeah, I think maybe the first step for that is to kind of strengthen the relationship between different communities, administration, so they do feel that sort of comfort.
Yeah, so absolutely. And so Student Life has been trying really, really hard to meet with lots of different folks, and we will continue to do that. I mean, absolutely. I think that's
we do need to do that. But I'm asking for your help. I'm saying we want to be helpful. But if I don't get in report, I mean, as I say, I've gotten a total in the last month of 13 bias or misconduct reports. And like one of them, I think, had to do with that thing.
Yeah, that's why I think the kind of divide between administration and students probably needs to be strengthened. Because
yeah.
Students don't feel comfortable to even voice, like, when they're going through something, then...
Okay, so how do how are we going to do that?
How are we going to do that? Strength and community knowledge students as well. As not someone who's not an expert on that, you know, I'm there, I'm just a student.
Yeah, no, like I'm not challenging. I'm really asking
for your help.
Yeah, for me personally, I feel like a lot of students feel that when they speak to administration, they're being spoken past. They're speaking past them, and administration's doing the same thing, or they don't have access to administration to speak to them.
Okay, So
Ryan, Vice President Ryan Lombardi has many, many, many meetings with students. And those of you who know Ryan know that Ryan never speaks past anyone.
Ryan is probably the best listener I've ever heard. So
if it's okay with you, I don't want to put you on the spot. You tell me afterwards.
But if it's okay with you, I would like to set up a meeting between you and Ryan so that you can talk with him more and maybe he can get more suggestions from you and you can get suggestions from me.
I don't want to put you on the spot. So you email me, president@cornell.edu.
I'll remember
Wallen.
And you tell me if you're comfortable with that. And if so, I'd be happy to set that up so we can try to make some progress there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Next one is from employees. And it is, how can employees participate in having the freedom to express themselves, and how can staff support or become involved with this year's theme? So first of all, staff are welcome at the free expression theme years. I know sometimes it's challenging because it conflicts with the time of your work, but please ask your supervisor if there's an event you're interested in. Please see if you can go to it. Also, organizational development and effectiveness, we call it ODE within the Office of Human Resources. They are rolling out a training series for staff this spring. The planning is still underway, but the expectation at this point is for a series of 6 sessions, which will focus on topics such as the history of free expression, its practical application in the university setting, and navigating the complexities of free expression in a diverse society. Also this spring, there's going to be an Inclusive Excellence Summit. Some of you have probably participated in the Inclusive Excellence Programming. And there's going to be at least one session there at their summit on free expression. And then the planning committee for the free expression theme year is seeking input. Like if you have ideas, they've heard from several staff members, they'd be happy to hear more ideas. The planning committee has a cost sharing agreement with the deans and the vice presidents. So if you have a suggestion of an event or an activity that would be of interest to staff, probably the best thing to do first is go to the dean or to the vice president and, you know, talk with them about it. And if they're interested, they all know that we have funds to do cost sharing with them. So if you have a good idea, let us know. It is true. I mean, I want to be honest here. It is true that while all of us have the responsibility to be caretakers for the university, principles of academic freedom and tenure do provide unique protections for faculty. That isn't the case for staff. That's just sort of how universities work. That's how academic freedom has evolved over time. And so, you know, I want to be honest about that. But that doesn't mean that we don't want to respect as much as possible the free speech rights, the free expression rights of our staff. And certainly we want to involve them in the activities of the theme year. Okay. There's a really interesting question now about statements. About presidential statements and when we make statements and, you know, how are we going to make different statements. This issue of statements it's really complicated. We spend an enormous amount of time, way too much time, frankly, trying to decide when should we issue a statement? Is this an event we should issue a statement to? Have we said the right thing? And people just parse and parse and parse statements like you wouldn't believe. I'll give you one example. Years ago, do people remember when the Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh, right, that synagogue in Pittsburgh, And I wrote that statement, and it happened to be that years ago, I lived less than a mile from that synagogue, and I lived in Pittsburgh, and I put something in my statement about that, and I was talking about how, you know, you never know when events around the world are going to impact you locally. And I was criticized because that statement was longer than the I don't remember what it was, than the previous statement I had denounced, and somehow that was interpreted as meaning that I cared more about that shooting than the previous shooting, when all it was that I was, you know, I happened to have this personal connection and I was trying to tell. So I talk all the time with my board, with university presidents, we talk all the time about statements. We have people in this community from all over the world, students, faculty, staff from all over the world. So that means almost any time an incident happens anywhere in the world, someone in our community is impacted by it. And then there are just always demands to make statements, always about political issues. So one thing that has been discussed a lot recently amongst sort of university leadership, not just here, I mean around the country, is something called the Calvin Report. The Calvin Report was written a long time ago in 1967 at the University of Chicago, and it has been used by the University of Chicago ever since as the basis of making or actually not making statements. So what the Calvin Report says is that a university leadership, not the university, but university leadership must remain neutral on all political and social issues. And why must it do that? It must do that because it says that's the only way that you can ensure the free speech rights of the students and faculty to make any statements they want, right-headed, wrong-headed, any statements they want about those events. Because anytime I, as president, make a statement, it kind of shuts down. It could potentially shut down other views. Basically, what it says is when the university makes a statement on any topic, it encroaches on the right of faculty and students and staff to adopt dissenting and disfavored ideas. And that's at odds with the long-term goals of the university to discover knowledge and truth. Now, it's a little bit complicated because it says, look, there are some limited circumstances in which a university has to make a statement. It should be able to make a statement where there are crises, and I'm going to quote, where society or segments of it threaten the very mission of the university and its values of free inquiry. So what are the questions that are being asked? The questions that are being asked are, okay, has this whole, like if you look over time, university presidents didn't used to make a lot of statements, and it's just grown and grown and grown and grown. So the question is, has this gotten out of control? Should we adopt the principles of the Calvin statement? Should we remain mum, not issue a statement in response to major domestic and international events? Is that feasible? Could we get away with that? I talked to the president of the University of Chicago shortly after October 7th, and he said, yeah, he was getting all this email, which was saying, yeah, we understand you'll make statements. But in this case, right? And also, how are we going to decide when a crisis is one where society or segments of it threaten the very mission of the university and its value of free and free. None of this is to answer the question of what are we going to do, because I don't know what we're going to do. What I do know is that this make a statement has gotten out of control. My team and I spend way too much time on it. And what often happens, and I'm not talking about the last 7 weeks, I'm talking about, right? What often happens is the anger or the frustration or the deep concern about the event that happened somewhere else gets deflected, and people forget all about the event, and it's all about what was in the statement, and that's not useful to anyone. So I guess what I'm saying to you is I'm grappling with this issue, and I don't have a good answer to it. Just trying to be honest. Okay. I think maybe this is the last question. Yeah, this is the last question. Although I have a fair amount of useful information here. This is a question about graduate fellows, and there's a lot of context about the difference in the way graduate fellows are treated or perceived to be treated than some other graduate appointments. So let me start by clarifying some things. So first of all, when we say fellowship at Cornell for graduate students, when we say fellowship, that's synonymous with scholarship. So a fellowship is a form of funding. And it's a form of funding that comes with no expectation of service or work or employment. So it's very different, say, from a teaching assistantship or a research assistantship. A fellow is expected to spend all of their attention and time on their own academic progress, and then the fellowship provides funding so that they can afford to do that. Under the National Labor Relations Act, The recently elected union for graduate assistants, I think everybody knows our graduate students just held an election for graduate assistants, and they are now bargaining as a union. The elected union for graduate assistants is positioned to bargain around the terms and conditions of employment. So assistantships are a form of employment, and the terms of the assistantship are under the purview of the union, but fellowships and scholarships are not. The terms of who was included and excluded were negotiated and agreed upon by the union. This wasn't something that the university unilaterally decided. So for those issues that fall outside of the employment sphere, all students, doesn't matter whether you're represented or not, have a voice in the university governance structures, things like GPSA, and through that have a voice in policies and procedures. These bodies, GPSA, it's undergraduates essay, these bodies can raise concerns about academic policies, campus climate, grievance channels, a range of other topics, including everybody's favorite parking. I wish I had a simple answer. The demand is really high. Space is really limited. Believe it or not, this is a problem on like every single campus I know in the country. All graduate students do have parking options. We know graduate students want more on central campus, and not just doctoral students. You know, professional students, undergraduates also commute. They want parking as well. TAs and GSRAs, graduate assistants, made a very compelling case that they have unique needs because of their employment duties and their schedules. They're very often very similar to faculty and staff. So we recognize that, and we provided them with a parking option in line with those expectations. But here's what I really want to emphasize. Even as we recognize the choice of graduate students to be represented by a union, our commitment is that the core role of all graduate students at Cornell is to be students. They're here to obtain a world-class education and training in their chosen discipline. So going back to the context that I didn't read to you, to me, the core issue here is not whether or not we are going to somehow be able to, you know, create more central campus parking spaces, but rather that if we have a student who feels like their purpose is providing a benefit to Cornell and not gaining the benefits of a Cornell education, then that's something we need to address and fix. To me, that's the central issue here. I wish I had an issue to the parking. That seems like it would be simple, but unfortunately it's not because we just don't have space. So I think I've left us. No, I'm beyond time. Hopefully that was helpful. Do you want to take one more question?
If there's time. I actually want to ask a follow-up to that. So I'm a graduate student on a fellowship, and I think that a lot of students feel that sentiment, the more disheartening sentiment of providing a service to the university still in a lot of ways. And I've heard that a lot from my colleagues. I think often it comes out in small things, like, you know, you work so hard to get a fellowship and now you make a couple $1,000 less than your fellow students in the summertime because of small things here and there. Or and you're not allowed to have parking, which I can get over, but I understand the feeling. The feeling is that, oh, maybe I'm being overlooked, or oh, maybe I'm not getting as much as I'm giving, or something along those lines. What are ways do you think we as a university can address those feelings and maybe make those students feel more seen and more supported?
The folks in HR are trying to address some of these issues, but the point I was trying to make is that if you are an assistant, a teaching assistant or a research assistant, then you're working for the university, right? That's why you're represented by a union. And the decision about parking, for example, was tied to that. It was tied to the demands of when you had to be here, right? If you're on a fellowship, you're not. Now I get the challenge of, although don't we require summer funding now? I thought we were
funding is required, but if you're at fellowship, it's required that so you're given whatever your fellowship gives for the summer. So I'm on the NSF JIRA, and it's about $3,000 less.
And are the TAs teaching in the summer?
No.
I see. Okay, I don't have a good answer. I don't have a good answer. I do know that Christine Lovely is out of town. I do know that the head of HR is concerned about these issues, and it may be that there are some ways to work around some of them. I'm going to be honest. I don't think there's a good solution to parking. That's why I went to that one. But I know that she is concerned about that. What we want, of course, is for our students to have great educations and to get out quickly. I mean, there's no, you know, you should be here getting your education and going on and doing great things with it. But let me, I don't have a good answer for you. Let me follow up with Christine.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you mind if I just chime in a quick comment? I'm not looking for an answer, just you're going to talk to people about graduates.
Yeah.
Just the perspective as well. I guess another way that fellows feel that all of their hard work to obtain fellowships is for nothing is like comparative to other prestigious universities. For example, I have two fellowships. I do not get any bonuses. I actually make less during the summer, and I have the same amount of responsibilities as a graduate research assistant. That is where the misnomer is.
So you should not have the same, if you have the same responsibilities as a graduate research assistant, then something's wrong, because a fellowship is not supposed to come. That's the whole point of a fellowship.
Well, the point of a graduate research assistant is that they're supposed to be working for the lab. When you're on a fellowship, the point of your fellowship is you're supposed to be working for the lab as well. It's those two are, I feel like the TA ships can be.
I mean, look, for what it's worth, when I was in graduate school, I had a fellowship for part of the time, and I had a research assistant for part of the time, and they were very different. When I had the fellowship, I was working on my dissertation all the time, or, you know, 95% of the time. Sometimes the advisor might need something. When I was a research assistant, I spent my 20 hours a week helping, I was a computer scientist, helping develop and debug code. It was a completely different situation. So if a graduate fellowship is really the same as a research assistantship, then we need to look into that too, because that should not be the case.
I think the sentiment for many students, maybe not all of them, but many students, is the people in their labs who are on GRAs work just the same amount on their dissertation as fellows do. But the point I wanted to bring up is that other prestigious universities, when you receive multiple fellowships, they give you bonuses.
So these are very fair questions. My advice is go and talk with Catherine Bohr, because she will sort of be closer to the ground on this than I am, and will be. I mean, I'm happy to come back in, but start with Dean Bohr, because she'll be closer to the details on how this works than I am, and then come back to me if that doesn't work.
Okay, thank you.
Right, up to you, but I have to go really soon.
I just wanted to make a quick comment. I'm glad you're talking about the Calvin Report. I think from the student end, we would appreciate if the university sort of looks into those principles, because we feel sort of that would be helpful. A lot of mess we've been in, it's a refreshing
term. Great. I'm gonna leave these. Please read this essay by Jane Marie Law. It's just a beautiful, beautiful essay, and it will, with everything going on in the world, it will make you feel good about being at Cornell. Thank you all. I hope you all have a really happy holiday season and get some relaxation. And please send me an email and let me know.
Thank you so much for your time today, President Pollack. We appreciate it. Okay, everyone. So next, we are going to transition into our... Do you guys hear an echo on your end?
No, but it might be her mic.
Okay, it might just be me. So we're going to transition into our share presentation. We are so grateful to have a guest speaker here with us today. So I'll just give a few minutes so we can transition over, and stay tuned.
Sure. Would you like to sit there, and then I'll navigate through your slides? It's really 4:24. Yeah.
The border.
The room mics are really
good. That's fine. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. I'll just jump right in, I guess. Thank you so much for inviting me to come speak with you all today. Very glad to be talking about this subject. It's a subject I present on every 2 years to the Coalition of Sexual Violence Prevention. But I'm happy to also give this discussion kind of at venues across campus to student groups or whoever might be interested or benefit from it. My name is Jason Hecht. I'm from the Office of Institutional Research and Planning. I do primarily survey research for the university. And before that, I'm also an alum. I was a grad student here and I graduated in 2014. So happy to be here with you all and to meet you all today. Eric, would you mind sitting down? Okay. So this is a pretty detailed presentation. To be quite honest, I don't think I'm going to make it through all of it, especially at this time of day. The content is pretty dense and difficult. So what I'm going to do is kind of talk about some of these headline results, and then I'll move through the presentation kind of as rapidly as I can to within the allotted time. But feel free to interrupt with questions. That's really what I'm most interested in, is just kind of to engage with you all about the data and use that as a starting point for a conversation. The other caveat I should give is that I partner with this work with Laura Weiss in the Scorton Center. She's one of the victim advocates. She's wonderful, but she's really the content area expert. So, I've worked with Laura enough that I know some of what she might say in certain situations, but in other situations about policies or the way that we might respond to some of these situations, she's really the kind of expert on that. And so I'll kind of refer any questions to her or to the share website. Excuse me. Okay, so skipping ahead, just to kind of, I'm going to tell you kind of the important stuff beforehand, and then we can dive into the details of it. When we look at most levels of sexual violence and related harassment or misconduct on campus, what we see, so this is a survey that was done every 2 years, is that we see a reversion to pre-COVID levels on many prevalence measures that we're going to look at here. And so essentially, in terms of when we talk about overall violence statistics, sexual violence statistics, the medium term trend kind of back to 2015 looks essentially flat, right? So things aren't really changing very much, either in a good way or a bad way. As I'll kind of explain later, last time this survey was done in 2021, the campus environment was very different. I don't know if many of you noted here or some of you not have, but thinking about back to a time of kind of social distancing, limits of the kind of the number of people who are supposed to attend certain kinds of events and functions and things like this. And so the environment just looked very, very different. And so the data looks a little bit different a couple years ago. And what we're seeing is kind of a reversion back to where we were previously. Underrepresented groups on campus are overrepresented in the data. Unfortunately, that's also part of our kind of more medium-term trend. It's not something that's new to this survey necessarily. We see LGBTQ identifying individuals identifying with disabilities, gender non-conforming individuals, all kind of represent higher levels of violence and misconduct towards them than other groups who don't share those kind of characteristics. And I'll talk about more specifics about that in the presentation itself. One thing that is new this time around is we see an increase in stalking behaviors. We have some idea from the survey about a little bit about what's kind of driving that. But that's something that we see new this time, that's different than what we've seen in years past. And then the fifth point is really the most important point. It's sort of the most important point every time I give the presentation, regardless of the year, is that the number one thing that we see is that victims and survivors talk to their friends about this issue. Right? So there's a lot of great resources on campus. Laura could tell you more about them. The SHARE website talks about lots of them. But we see in the data over and over again that when assault and violence happens towards the students on campus, by and large, they talk to their friends about it. So one of the reasons I think these kinds of presentations and these discussions are important is by having kind of a well-educated community on this issue, well-informed community, it helps kind of our response, because oftentimes the first people to respond, the people who hear about this first, are students and not necessarily our staff or faculty. Eric, would you? Thank you. Okay, we'll go through this one quickly. So this is our fifth survey of campus sexual violence. We invited a sample of 6,000 students from our Ithaca, Weill, and Cornell Tech campuses. So, and the reason for those campuses in particular is because this is a New York State requirement. So New York State requires us every 2 years to conduct this survey of sexual violence on campus. And so we cover kind of all the campuses within New York State. Our response rate this time around was 36%, which is pretty comparable to what we saw in 2021 and also in past years. And so moving forward, kind of what the presentation is gonna focus on is the prevalence and context of sexual assault and misconduct. So where these things happen and more about the characteristics of the people they happen to and the characteristics of the offenders who do them. And also, again, addressing who students do and don't talk to about these experiences. And again, see very clear evidence that students talk to other students by and large about this, even though we have a lot of other great resources around campus for students who are unfortunate victims of sexual violence incidents. Okay. I want to talk about stalking first, just because it's one that jumped out this year as being different than past years. And you'll see kind of most of the slides are kind of a variation on this one. So what you'll see in the red bars are kind of the data from this year. So these were collected actually in the spring, so April and May 2023. And then in the black and then gray bars are the kind of previous year's results. And so what you'll see is at the top, the big jump in terms of stalking from 5% kind of since every year, since 2017 to 13% this year. And we really see that this is driven largely by the large increase in the number of unwanted calls, messages, pictures, or videos that were sent from students to students. So we see a big increase in the amount of students reporting that they're receiving these kinds of unwanted videos, and that kind of falls within the definition of stalking that we use for the survey and that the university uses. In terms of other forms of stalking, we see a slight uptick as well in terms of being spied, watched, or followed. But in general, just by the numbers, the unwanted calls, messages, or pictures are really kind of what's driving that increase that we saw this year. And this was something that when I met with the coalition, there was kind of a robust discussion across public safety and folks in Sport Center. Yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much for presenting this data. I was curious, do you have data on sort of disciplinary outcomes here? Sort of what percentage of these cases are sort of adjudicated in some way or another? Or?
I do not, because the survey does not constitute a bias report. So within the survey itself, we link to bias reports with the Office of Title IX, but within the survey itself, we don't ask about like, did you report this? Mm-hmm. What was the outcome of reporting that? Really what we want to do and what kind of the best practice that we know from research in the field is really is just to try to collect information about the incident itself. We have made some efforts in the past to roughly corroborate these with kind of what we know the campus safety complaints that they receive, and the numbers roughly line up in terms of, but we see many more kind of if as we go on the slides, it'll become kind of more clear, but there are many more people who tell us here that they were assaulted than ever get kind of reported on campus. Mm-hmm. So there's a big gap between the number of what people are telling us here and what the Title IX office receives in terms of formal complaints or requests for inquiry against students. We know that a large gap there exists for sure.
Yeah, thank you. I was just trying to curious if we could figure out what the size of that gap was or sort of what's reported and what's not. So,
yeah.
All right, thank you.
Sure. Great. Okay. Here we're looking at the prevalence of sexual and gender-based harassment, and we're looking for students since they've entered Cornell. We see that roughly 45% of students experience some form of harassing behavior, and the prevalence of kind of specific harassing behaviors are listed below that. Most frequently experienced forms of harassing behavior this year were, but they also have been in the past, someone making inappropriate or offensive comments about someone else's body, appearance, or sexual activities, or someone making sexual remarks or telling insulting or offensive jokes or stories. And as you can see, more than a third of students and a quarter of students respectively reported that this experience. One thing that is different this time around, kind of draw your attention to the bottom of the chart, and we see that more and more students who experienced harassing behaviors that had one or both negative impacts on them, that either they had to tolerate this behavior or fear jeopardizing their academic, professional, or other standing at Cornell within a group, and or that it interfered with one's participation in programs or activities. So as you see, for both of those, we see relatively large jumps this year. So while the overall level of harassment, perhaps it hasn't changed as much, we are seeing more students say that the harassment is bad enough that it is affecting the way that they interact and engage with their activities on campus. Okay, here, what I want to do with this slide is just kind of point out in one example, again, of where we see underrepresented students on campus. So TGQN here refers to transgender, gender non-conforming, questioning, or non-binary students, right? And so we see here two things. So number one, undergraduates report sexual-based harassment much more frequently than kind of grad students do. And also we see that gender non-conforming transgender students report at a much higher rate of both men and women. Although the rates are high for across the board here that we see, here's one point of evidence where we see that kind of underrepresented groups on campus are somewhat overrepresented in their reports of violence that they've experienced since coming to Cornell. This is that same graph, but looking at it again also by sexuality on the left, so LGBTQ identifying individuals versus straight individuals. And also on the right, individuals who identify as having a disability versus individuals who don't identify as having a disability. And this is a pattern that we've seen again year after year since I've been doing this, and also going back to 2017 when the first Cornell survey was done, is that we see in the data LGBTQ students and students with disabilities consistently report, again, experiencing violence and harassment more than other groups. But here we're looking specifically just at the sexual and gender-based harassment angle. And here we're looking at, again, sexual and gender-based harassment, but by race. And what we see here is that Latinx and multiracial for both men and women across the board, multiracial identifying individuals report harassment at somewhat higher levels than other groups. This is something that again was a topic of discussion at the coalition meeting, but discussion is kind of ongoing, and these are data that we're looking to try to understand better. Okay. All right, so who's behaving in a harassing manner? So this is asking individuals of the incidents of harassment that they're referring to when they say that they have been harassed, who are the individuals who are doing the harassing? And you'll notice a few key differences here between undergraduates and graduate and professional students. The common part is that for both undergrads and grad professionals, that students are by far the most likely group other students to be there, those who are doing the harassing. But for grad and professional students, you'll also notice that faculty and staff and administrators are also much more likely than relative to undergrads to be sources of harassment for our grad and professional population. You also see that in the kind of slide, the relationship of harasser to the victim, oftentimes, especially in the undergrad's case, it's someone who they just met at a social event. So about a third of the people reporting this, it's someone who they might not have known previously. And we also see here, that by and large, in terms of the someone I don't know or recognize, that by and large, although that the individual who's doing the harassing is someone who is known to the person reporting it in some capacity or another. So even if it's someone they just met, it's not someone who might be from outside the community. So by and large, we know that these incidents are being perpetuated by people who are internal to the Cordell community. And in rare instances, they also involve individuals who are from outside the community. Moving along to discussing non-consensual sexual contact. The survey asked students about their experiences with two forms of non-consensual sexual contact. That could be penetration, either completed or attempted, or oral contact, as well as sexual touching. And then there's kind of four modalities, if you will, that we could recognize here for parts of the survey by which this non-consensual sexual contact could occur. Physical threats or threats of physical force, incapacitation, force of threats of non-physical harm or promises of rewards, as well as the absence of affirmative consent. And so then we ask about it in a couple different ways. We ask whether the incident that occurred since the student's been enrolled at Cornell, or whether it's occurred in the actual year itself. Feel free to go ahead, thanks. And so what you'll see here is what I was referring to earlier in the sense of most of the data in the medium term has stayed relatively similar. We see that 11% of all students report some form of non-consensual sexual contact involving force or incapacitation since entering Cornell. And we also see that this is particularly prevalent amongst undergraduate women. So for undergraduate women, 23% of them on this past year's survey reported some form of non-consensual sexual contact since entering the university. Now what we do is we look at the data just for this past academic year. And again, so we see that whereas the previous slide was cumulative, this was just was asking about just the 22-23 academic year. We see across all students, about 6% of the population reported being a victim of non-consensual sexual contact last academic year. And again, for undergraduate women, we see that number being particularly high with about 13% of undergraduate women reporting last academic year that they were the victim of non-consensual sexual contact. One thing I also want to point out here is if you look at the black bar just to the left of the red bars, you'll notice, for example, in all students and undergraduate women, you'll see that it looked like when we were looking at these data in 2021, we weren't sure exactly what we were looking at in the sense that we saw these drop-offs and we weren't sure if we were kind of on a different trajectory or whether this was kind of an artifact of the particular time that we were in the pandemic where social distancing and so forth, what I was discussing before, were a thing. And so unfortunately now what we see this year, one of the big lessons from this year's data is that kind of that 2021 data is a bit of an aberration based on kind of the unique context that we were in at the time, how we've kind of reverted back to a path that we that we've been on previously. That's relatively unchanged since 2017. Again, I want to zoom in here now just on undergraduate women, because they are among the groups that report the highest levels of non-consensual sexual contact. And what you'll see here is also, again, I want to point out the kind of the big jump in first year students that we see between 2021 and 2023. So in 2021, we had 7% of undergraduate women reporting that they had experienced some form of non-consensual sexual contact. In this past year, that number jumped up to 18%, which is really consistent with what we've seen in the past. So again, more evidence that kind of 2021 was different for all the reasons we've talked about, and that again, in general, we're seeing a trend that is more or less flat. The other number that sticks out a lot is that 2019 number, especially for juniors. That's been something that, again, kind of sticks out as something that has been talked about with colleagues in campus safety and the health center, and we still don't have a good understanding about juniors in 2019 and understanding what happened there. But we continue to kind of work forward and try to understand the patterns to the best that we can. You know what, Eric, in the interest of time, will you skip ahead? Okay. Here again, I want to point out kind of, as we did before, that underrepresented groups overrepresented in the data. So again, we see, looking at sexuality on the left, LGBTQ individuals versus straight individuals, and individuals with a disability on the right versus individuals without. We all see in both cases that those who are underrepresented, again, are shown more commonly in the data. The other thing that is worth noting is that this disability finding is not one that's unique to our campus, but is also one that's not really well understood when you look at academic research about the topic, why individuals with disabilities report incidences of sexual violence or misconduct more frequently than those who don't identify as having a disability. That's not clear and kind of just remains a question that's out there for someone to understand better, but it's one that we're always working to understand here. And it's something that jumps out in the data every year. It's not new to this year, but it's something that, again, we're trying to understand better. Again, we're looking at race, and I'll just kind of, again, in the interest of just trying to move quickly. Again, on this slide, we see that multiracial and Latinx identifying women are, again, among the highest reported victims on this category for non-consensual sexual contact. The pattern doesn't appear quite as closely for men looking at it this way as it did previously, but again, we're seeing with women the same pattern where we look at across undergraduate women that Latinx and multiracial women, again, identified as the groups reporting the highest levels of non-consensual sexual contact in this past survey. Okay. What the survey then does, once we've established, just out of curiosity, has anyone taken the survey? What you'll see is that individuals who identify as having had an incident of non-consensual sexual contact, they're asked if this has occurred to them once or more than once. If it's occurred more than once, what we ask them to do is to focus on what they consider to be the most serious incident, and we ask them specific details about that incident in particular to try to gather data around it. Again, what we'll see is that, again, the offenders by and large are primarily other Cornell students. For grads and professionals, we see a bit under a quarter are individuals who are not affiliated with Cornell. Most of those individuals, though, are not anonymous or strangers. They're just folks who grad students or undergrads happen to know from outside of the context of the university. Let's just skip ahead. Okay. This data is also always very interesting to look at, which is for this most serious incident, where did it occur? So about 30% of these incidents occur within undergraduate residence halls, primarily undergraduate residence halls. There are a few graduate residence halls, but primarily undergraduate. And the vast majority of the reports that we had in this year's survey, over 90% are North Campus, as opposed to, we divided up into three groups, North Campus, West Campus, and then I think it's South Campus, like College Town and the apartments there. But we see that more than 90% of those who are reporting that their incident occurred within a residence hall, more than 90% of them report that residence hall being located on North Campus. See smaller numbers, somewhat smaller numbers for private residences and fraternity chapters as well. We also see that fraternity annexes, of all the trends that look like they're declining, that actually looks like that's a real trend that's declining down because of university policy, that because of changes in way that the those annexes are kind of the policies around them and the way they're kind of policed and scrutinized, that we have seen kind of declines in the number of incidences that are reported as occurring in annexes. Okay. Here's the really important slide that I was kind of pointing to at the beginning, right? So who do you talk to about this? Most people tell someone, right? So we see that about 13% of women and 15% of men don't tell anyone at all, but over 80% of both men and women talk to someone about it, and mostly they talk to their friends. So well over 80% for both men and women discuss it with their friends. Next most likely would be a family member or a spouse or partner, and then somewhat less. Excuse me, a health professional. Go ahead. Okay, this was, so I'll end here. I hope I did okay on time. I wanna point you just in the direction of the SHARE website. Excuse me, the website has a lot of different resources about this topic overall. I think it's something that, the university should be and is very proud of in terms of the development resources that are on there. We also specifically, I'm pointing here towards, there's a longer, if you're interested in more details about this, there's a longer report of the data and then a discussion that appeared in the Cornell Chronicle and kind of the university's response to the data. So it's all kind of very comprehensively tracked every 2 years. And it's something that while, as you've seen from the presentation, that these unfortunate incidents continue to occur at much higher levels than we'd like them to, but it's really our commitment, my office's commitment, along with the Skorton Center, making sure that we document it, that we track these trends over time, and that we be able to kind of know how that we're doing, so that we can hopefully one day get to a point where our campus is kind of our campus is a safer place for everyone, and this issue hopefully will, if not go away, be one that we spend less time scrutinizing. But for the time being, as you can see, it continues to be a major issue on campus that affects way more students than we'd like it to. And that's all. I thank you for your attention. I know it's late in the day for this kind of discussion of this kind of topic, but I really appreciate the invitation. And if there's time remaining, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so very much for your time. Can we get a round of applause? Thank you. Just a note, we are going to have to make a motion to extend time. I think let's, for the time being, extend it to 6:25. If we could have someone make that motion, I would welcome that at this time.
Motion to extend to 6:25.
Seconded. And a second?
Seconded.
Thank you. Okay, so now may it be reflected in the minutes that this meeting has been extended to 6:25. Do we have any questions for our presenter at this time?
Yeah, I had a question to what was kind of the response of administration when you're presented with findings? Is it kind of going to be an increase in, I guess, resources or proactive measures?
It's a good, so that's a, again, not for my first question to be one, like Laura should better answer that question with you. So I'm kind of separate from the infrastructure that provides the student support because I'm not within the health center itself. So I don't know, I know there are ongoing discussions, but no idea like whether those resources are actually gonna happen. My understanding is, you know, one of the reasons that I guess that partially when I show these data to Laura that she's not surprised that things haven't looked like they've changed much since 2017 is because the amount of resources has not changed dramatically since that time. So on the one hand, the efforts that are going on campus of Laura and her colleagues and her team, the work that they do is really fantastic, but obviously is not enough to keep the levels kind of, the levels are where they are. And hopefully we'll get lower at a certain point in time, but it's hard to know exactly when we should expect that to happen with a kind of relatively consistent level of resources. But I can't personally speak to, what those discussions look like or whether we're expecting that those resources will be forthcoming.
Yeah, just to add on to that, Laura leads the Cornell Social Consultants, which then go and evaluate the space, come up with interventions. So there is work being done on this issue with the respective communities and getting buy-in and also knowledge of how they operate.
Yeah.
I think the most striking thing to me from the PowerPoint was that although rates have returned to similar rates around 2017, the same proportion of students are being hit. So does that imply that the same students are repeatedly suffering from these incidences? Because by the time of graduation, it's the same proportion of the population, even of the students who started in the
pandemic. Right. Because of the way we collect the data, it's hard to know whether it's the same students. What I can say is, even if it's not the same, like me personally, student, the demographics look very similar, right? So we can say with a fairly high level of confidence that kind of the demographics of students who are reporting these kinds of incidences remain relatively consistent as well. So that even if it's not the exact same individuals reporting it, it's perhaps the same communities who for whatever reason are more vulnerable than others for being victims of assault or other misconduct, that we see those patterns again. So that, on the one hand, we want to see the rates go down, but seeing them be as consistent as they are across demographics gives us confidence in the instrument that we're measuring something real, because by and large, we don't know that it's not the exact same students, but based on the way we draw the sample, it's very unlikely, like probably a very small percentage of the people who are reporting on multiple surveys.
I had a follow-up question, sure. Not related though.
No.
So the disabled and also minority student rates, what does that compare to the national average? I know for the queer students, it's about similar because I used to do infographics on that, but I don't know about the other groups. Is that?
So yeah, so this year, unfortunately, in past years, we've had a better sense of comparative data, how we stack up comparatively. I applaud the effort that the university has gone to because of the New York State requirement, but also because it wants to do the right thing of that we followed up and did the survey. Many schools have not continued on since the pandemic with collecting similar data. There's a variety of reasons for that, one of which is because there is discussion of this being mandated on a national level. So there's a lot of schools who are waiting to say, we want to see if there's going to be a national mandate within Title IX. For there to be kind of a survey that all universities use. And then as we're waiting for this, then maybe we don't have to do one now. So they do, in the past, they have compared reasonably closely to kind of peer institutions of a similar size. Unfortunately, this year, our data on that is really limited to other SUNY schools. And for a lot of reasons, we're very different than what kind of other SUNY schools look like. So it's hard to say, but in the past they've been relatively consistent that we haven't been kind of a big outlier in one area with respect to certain demographic groups or others. Does that answer?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I may have misunderstood. Well, thank you for your presentation. I may have misunderstood, but on some of your slides, it looked like your earlier slides, it looked like there was an increase from 2017 in the prevalence of certain incidents. And then also one of your later slides, it looked fairly consistent for undergraduate women, for example, but much higher for trans questioning. So has there been an increase for that demographic?
Yeah, so the trans and gender non-conforming data is really interesting here. And the reason it's interesting is because I know not necessarily even from this survey, but for example, our office also does like the new student survey that students take when they come in as undergraduates for orientation. And we know from sources like that, right, that the number of students who identify as transgender or gender non-conforming is growing by leaps and bounds literally every single year. So the numbers for transgender, gender non-conforming students here, what I kind of have said in the past about those data is that they really kind of, the numbers are still low enough that they haven't really settled. There's a lot of noise because we're still talking about, in this case, I think that this year we had about 80 respondents who identified as a gender non-conforming category, which is about double than what it was in 2021. So being about 40 students, but again, then when you're dealing with kind of a relatively low number of observations, there's going to be a lot of noise in those patterns. So I don't believe those numbers as much, but I think there's kind of wider error bands around them. But I think as we get more and more students who continue to identify with those groups, like other categories, we will see like kind of those numbers start to stabilize as we get kind of consistently higher number of observations.
Hi, everyone. We only have time for one more question. So if anyone wants to make the last bid, you may do so at this time. If not, then can we have another round of our applause for our presenter? I'm so grateful that you came here and spoke with us today. We look forward to keeping in contact with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the invitation.
Okay, everyone, progressing through our agenda, we have a few more things. So first we're going to have our assembly reports in this order: student assembly, grad and professional student assembly, employee assembly, and then faculty senate. So will representatives from those assemblies please speak now?
Yes, I can start. The student assembly obviously did not operate last week because of Thanksgiving. And we have one more meeting this year, this coming Thursday, where we will pass our student activity fee, and hopefully it will then be approved by the president. It is a pretty significant increase. But Rocco, our vice president of finance, two to my left, has done incredible work in terms of documenting and providing justification for pretty significant increase. Mainly, interestingly, the student activity fee that was set 2 years ago, which was a dollar increase, actually was a negative increase for many organizations because of inflation. So historically, the student activity fee has tracked under inflation, and hopefully this year we'll be able to bring it up to a place that's actually feasible for students. Rock has also done pretty significant work on the price index of other fees and services that student organizations utilize and depend on. For example, artist prices for a lot of the large-scale events that we put on campus have actually tracked over 3 times inflation over the course of the last 2 years, aptly named the Gunna Price Index. And so hopefully that all goes well. We're not expecting a huge challenge to pass it this Thursday. Luckily, we've had pretty significant discussion about every single byline organization that we've gone through over the course of the semester. So hopefully it will be relatively smooth this Thursday. We also have a lot of other initiatives that are going on, most of which I've talked about at previous university assembly meetings. So I'll get there.
And for the graduate and professional student assembly, we did successfully pass our activity fee for the next 2 years at our last meeting, which was before Thanksgiving break. We were planning to send it to approval for the president soon. We just had to change the layout or something of the resolution. But that was passed. It is around, I believe, a 30% increase or so from $85 to $110. Still quite a bit below the student activity fee, but yeah, it hadn't been changed dramatically in a while, so it would be caught up as well. Another news, grad students have a union now, so we'll see how that affects the functioning of GPSA as a whole. And then finally, our main action of our last meeting, which will be next Monday, is likely to bring a resolution to the floor about using some of our reserve fund to help Cornell Cinema purchase more equipment for hosting outdoor movie screenings over the summer months. So that is likely to be the focus of our last meeting. Thanks.
Okay, hi everyone. For the employee assembly, I don't have a lot to update you with. Just in our past meeting last week or 2 weeks ago, we were able to add two new members through incidental vacancies, which is really exciting. Just we're getting our membership up. We have a few more people presenting at our next meeting to fill the additional vacancies. So we're helping to get the membership up. I think the EA Voice newsletter has really helped generate some interest. And we are working on one resolution. It's still pretty preliminary and some outreach events. But once I have more concrete information, I'll provide those updates. So thank you.
All right, everyone, thank you. Next, we have our committee reports. First, we have the executive committee, followed by campus codes, campus welfare, and site.
All right. So with the executive committee, we had a lot of discussion, of course, about questions to submit to President Pollack for her presentation today, but in addition to that, we talked about the meeting structure for UA meetings and how we can help committees meet on a more regular basis that isn't totally left up to folks to try to figure out with your schedules, right? So we were thinking about dedicating 30 to 45 minutes during the open forum time to committee meetings, right? So you can separate and talk about the things that you need. That would be the one meeting per month, right? That you would be able to just invite your committee members and that'll be set. So that way it takes some of the pressure off of those committee chairs to set those meetings for folks and try to juggle those schedules. So we were thinking about that in our committee meeting, as well as talking about how we can bring up additional issues that may affect the university, like from our various assembly constituencies, because we don't talk a lot about that in our open forum space. Like, what are the issues that are on each of our assembly floors that may affect another assembly, so you can garner some support in those areas? It may not affect all of us, right? But if there's something happening in GPSA that may affect like faculty senate, right? That may be something you wanna bring to university assembly so that way we can help support that effort and moving that forward. But that is all from the executive committee.
Yeah, for me, the campus codes committee, last time we kind of circled up, talked about the ideas, things that we want to accomplish with that. I'd sent out a when to meet, but I neglected to follow up on that, so that's definitely on me. A lot of other stuff that had recently come up in my life that I had to go deal with separately. But in doing that, right, I got a chance to sit down with Christine Liang, the director of the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards, to talk about some of the ideas that we did have and that we did discuss. I think currently, as President Pollack talked about, they're working on this doxing policy. And, you know, in order to implement something like that in the student code, it would have to go through the codes committee and then be voted on. So we're probably going to try to time, you know, at least tackle that aspect first, because that is super important. And then some of the other things like the different standards of evidence within the code and sort of those stipulations, those will be later in the spring semester. It may be even over the winter break if people agree to meet.
Okay, so the C site we met yesterday. We kind of went over last year's issues related to what was done and what could be done within the committee. A lot of the issues are kind of that we one don't have funding, and then also we kind of need to focus on following through what we have. But some of the things we'd like to see done is kind of maybe retrofitting buildings on campus, tackling types of waste, and asking Cornell to be more involved in local sustainability initiatives. They have been involved, they have certain projects, particularly within like global development or environmental sustainability, with more things abroad, but how can we bring some of those things to the community? So I think next steps for us is to, we drafted a list of each org that is listed as a sustainability org, and then going to add different departments on that, and then want to send out a survey to see what can we meet, how can we meet the needs of the people. And then, yeah, and also setting up a meeting with Rebecca Evans. She's the local Ithaca, I think she works in the sustainability office in Ithaca. So how can we foster a relationship with the local community and Cornell?
Thank you all. Do we have any reports from the Campus Welfare Committee?
Our chair is not here, and I don't think we've met since the last, we gave an update at the last meeting. We haven't met since then.
Not a problem. Okay, so it is 6:26 now, and we've reached the conclusion of our agenda. I would at this time welcome any motions to adjourn. And before we do, thank you all so much for your flexibility with my virtual presence this semester. I'm really excited to join you all in person in the spring. We have now concluded our fall semester meeting, so congratulations to all of you. Now I'd welcome motions to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn. Second.
Thank you all. I'll see you in the spring.
Does anybody want to